The next case of the morning is number 064419, Michael Fowler against Caremark Prescription. Mr. Leonard, why don't we just wait till the courtroom clears and people settle down, okay? Mr. Leonard, I think we can get underway.
May it please the court, Mike Leonard on behalf of the appellants who were the whistleblowers in the underlying action. We ask this court to reverse the district court's finding that the whistleblowers should not have been given leave to file a Third Amendment complaint in this case and to proceed with that action. I'd like to address the jurisdictional issues first and then address the Rule 9b and Rule 8a issues. The crux of the jurisdictional dispute centers on Caremark's contention that its mere production of documents to the government negates jurisdiction over the whistleblower's claims. Now, it's undisputed that the production by Caremark of documents to the government did constitute a public disclosure, according to this court's holding in Matthews. However, that public disclosure is only meaningful and only triggers this court's jurisdictional analysis if the whistleblower's allegations in a Third Amendment complaint were in fact based upon that public disclosure, because if they were not, this court need go no further and need not engage in the original source exception inquiry to the jurisdictional bar. And Caremark itself realizes that, and they ask this court to reverse itself with respect to Matthews. And interestingly enough, they agree with the portions of Matthews that support it in this case, but ask this court to reverse itself on based upon. This court, as it knows, found that based upon means derived from, which makes sense. It comports with the plain language of the statute. More importantly, it's consistent with the goals of the 1986 amendments to the False Claims Act. Namely, those were to encourage greater whistleblower participation in lawsuits, encourage the bringing of more whistleblower lawsuits, and most importantly, bar only cases that are truly parasitic, meaning somebody who reads about something or copies something and doesn't bring anything to the table themselves tries to proceed on that claim. We don't have that in this case. And the fact that there's a debate between some of the circuits about whether based upon means similar to or based upon means derived from what this court found is not a reason for this court to overturn itself. In fact, we've seen no evidence since 1999 that any parasitic lawsuits have fallen through the cracks in this circuit because of this court's holding in Matthews. And in fact, this debate about based upon continues till today. There's a recent decision, Rost versus Pfizer, from a district court in Massachusetts in 2006 at 446 F-SUP, where they explain this debate and the fact that it still rages. And in that case, the court agreed with this court's interpretation in Matthews. But the important thing is that when we apply that derived from standard to this case, it's unquestionably clear that the relators did not derive their allegations, the schemes, from Caremark's production of documents to the government. And in fact, based upon the factual record, it's sort of an absurd proposition. First of all, they derived the allegations and the schemes from their own personal knowledge. The four relators in this case worked at Caremark for a combined more than 25 years. The record is clear. They participated in the schemes. They observed the schemes firsthand. Two of the relators worked at a facility in Florida. Two of the relators worked at a facility in Texas. They took documents from the company during their employment to corroborate the schemes. That also is undisputed. And they did that at great personal risk. Interestingly enough, Caremark sued two of the relators in Florida state court saying, you couldn't take those documents, but yet they stand before this court today and say, essentially, you didn't take enough documents, because if you don't take all the documents, then somehow you're deriving your allegations from a public disclosure. But the whistleblowers didn't do just that. They also got sworn statements and witness summaries that they also provided to the government. Everything that we've spoken about was provided to the government before the whistleblowers filed their Third Amendment complaint. And finally, the fourth prong of their derived from allegations were discovery materials produced by Caremark to the relators in this case. Unquestionably, according to Matthews, those discovery materials are not public disclosures. So again, the court would have to overrule itself in a second issue in Matthews when there's no reason to do so. In sum, the district court put it best. These are the very type of whistleblowers the 86 amendments were designed to encourage. And there would be significant policy consequences for this court to reverse itself. For instance, why would relators, such as these relators, cooperate with the government at all and help build a case? What Caremark says is essentially the whistleblowers, when asked by the government to assist them in gathering documents and information, should have said, well, there's really nothing you need to get. There's nothing that would help your case. Because if the whistleblowers cooperate with the government and the government gets documents through those efforts, the whistleblowers are barred from using them, according to Caremark's theory. In addition, there's no incentive to take discovery. Because if you take discovery and provide the defendant with a request for documents or a roadmap to your case, all they have to do, according to their theory, is produce those same documents to the government, and you're barred from relying upon them. And that's nonsensical. That takes us back to where we were prior to the 86 amendments when this Seventh Circuit considered Wisconsin versus Dean. And this court had to hold that because documents were merely in the government's files, the case couldn't go forward. Well, we know Wisconsin versus O'Dean versus Dean was specifically addressed by the 86 amendments. And so just to have the documents in the government's files does not bar a claim. So we asked that the court should hold in the first instance that the relator's allegations were not in any way derived from Caremark's separate production of documents to the government. So there's no need for this court to go to the second prong, which is the original source exception to the jurisdictional rule. But I would like to address that issue in case this court feels the need to overrule Matthews. Now, under the original source exception, the relators would still be found to have sufficient knowledge if their knowledge is, number one, direct, and number two, independent. We've talked about the various sources of their direct knowledge. I won't repeat those. But this court decided the Lamers case, Lamers versus City Green Bay. In that case, the whistleblower was quite unlike the relators in this case. In Lamers, the whistleblower was what this court called a mere busybody. What the gentleman did, he was in competition with the government. He watched the bus routes take place, and from that public viewing of activities, he fashioned a False Claims Act case. This court said that was enough direct evidence. Clearly, if the relator in Lamers met the standard of direct knowledge, the whistleblowers here clearly do. Another question for the court is, do they have independent knowledge, meaning knowledge derived separate and apart from the public disclosures? Yes, again, they have discovery materials, documents they took, sworn statements, etc. These guys are the classic insiders.
Can you just comment on something here, that the Rule 8 requires that a complaint be a short and concise statement of the claim? I understand that when a fraud is involved, you've got to do a little more pleading with specificity, but these complaints are gigantic. I mean, 178 pages, 119 pages. How does that square with being a short and concise statement of a claim?
It's tough, Judge, because we're definitely between a rock and a hard place. The district court, and we should note that when the case was under seal and we filed our first amended complaint, the complaint was 51 pages. Judge Conlon stated very specifically that you have to have more detail, both of the schemes and of the submission of the false claims. So we're talking about six separate schemes carried out at four different facilities, and we're relying upon the knowledge of four relators. It's difficult. It's a difficult challenge. And in our second amended complaint, which was longer, much longer than the third amended complaint, we went into great detail laying out in the complaint the specific contractual provisions which we would later rely upon. And I could just hear the court, if we didn't have those in there, the district court would have said, you expect me to wade through all these exhibits and find out what contractual provisions you're talking about? So we took those out. That was probably a good 30 pages. But it was difficult in a concise fashion to comply with Rule 8, but at the same time meet the heightened pleading standards of Rule 9. And I think the purpose of Rule 8 overall is to provide enough factual detail that the defendant's on notice, but you're still battling the Rule 9 standard, which is heightened. And the district court made it clear, don't come back to me with a complaint that doesn't have specific examples of false claims. If you look at our Third Amendment complaint, The examples take up about one-third to one-half of the entire complaint. If we don't have those examples, according to the court, we're not even to come back to her. So I think that under the circumstances, we did what was appropriate. But I'd also like to address this issue that Caremark has sort of permeated the record with, which is the notion that but for their production of these documents to the government, the relators wouldn't have a claim. And then that's false for several reasons. As I just mentioned, by the time the relators had filed an amended complaint under seal, when not a scrap of paper had been produced to the government or to the relators, four out of the six schemes ultimately pled were in that complaint. Then we moved to the third amended complaint, and Caremark would have this court believe that somehow the two additional schemes, which were called the Lost in Transit scheme and the CCR scheme, somehow derived from the government producing documents. But there's not a shred of record evidence for that. In fact, with regard to the Lost in Transit scheme, there's no record evidence. Caremark produced a single piece of paper to the government or to the relators. So how could that additional scheme be derived from their production of documents to the government? Likewise, with respect to what we call the CCR scheme, the crux of that scheme is Caremark sending out these sort of out-of-the-blue letters to doctors saying, gee, why don't you think about making a switch to the drug regimen with absolutely no follow-up? And Caremark would have this court believe that somehow their production of documents to the government allowed us to somehow manufacture that scheme as well. But the record shows, with respect to CCR, that the evidence in support of that claim is their admission in sworn discovered materials in a related action that they never did anything to find out if there's any cause and effect between their sending the letters and these changes made to the drug regimens. So there is no basis for contending with regard to those claims or the others that somehow Caremark provided this golden ticket to the relators to fashion a claim. It's simply false. I'd also like to address the Rule 9b issues, which are intertwined with 12b6. First of all, with respect to the return drugs allegations, I'm sure this court is very familiar with the Cruz case, which it decided in 2006. It was a return drug case. That case relied heavily upon another return drug case called Omnicare from the Third Circuit. This case is entirely unlike both of those. And let's make it clear, we do not contend that Cruz was wrongly decided or Omnicare was wrongly decided. The facts and claims pled in this case are entirely different. As this court noted in Cruz, a relator must come to the court with a claim in hand. Here, we contend that Caremark received return drugs back, and before they sent out an invoice for those return drugs, they knew the drugs were returned and yet still invoiced the plans for those drugs. Now, that's entirely unlike Cruz or Omnicare. In fact, in Omnicare, the court specifically noted that if the relator could show that the defendant knew the drugs had already been returned before the invoice was sent out, he would have a claim. That's exactly what we have in this case. And I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Leonard. We'll hear now from Mr. Perl.
May it please the court. My name is Howard Perl. I represent Caremark, the defendant appellee in this case. Mr. Leonard started his argument with a concession that this case involved a public disclosure by Caremark. That is the most greatest understatement that one could imagine with respect to that. This was the paradigm of public disclosure. It's undisputed that Caremark voluntarily turned over to the United States Attorney's Office, obviously the preeminent agency responsible for deciding whether or not to bring a False Claims Act case, every single claim, transaction, report tendered to the various federal health plans. So there's not a single claim at issue in this case that wasn't fully disclosed as a transaction to the United States Attorney's Office voluntarily by Caremark. Mr. Leonard suggests that what we're asking you to do here today is to overrule Matthews. And I can't stress enough that's the last thing that we would be asking. Instead, we're asking you specifically to focus on what the court in Matthews specifically described as its limited holding. Mr. Leonard misstates the test articulated by the court in Matthews and followed by the court in Feingold. And that limited test does not refer in any way to public disclosure. Mr. Leonard, during his argument, framed everything in terms of, did you rely on, essentially, the actual public disclosure? The case never says that. Instead, it's a two-part test. Did the complaint and the relators essentially rely upon publicly disclosed information? And did they actually derive their claims from publicly disclosed information? No reference to the disclosure, it's relying on the disclosure itself. The only issue is, was it publicly disclosed information? Mr. Leonard also suggests that they didn't rely on, in any meaningful sense, anything other than their years of employment. There are three fundamental building blocks to this case. The first is, what were Caremark's business practices? There's no question that as employees of the company, they were familiar and had direct independent knowledge of various business practices. But this is not a statute designed to redress troublesome business practices, hence the name False Claims Act. There has to be a link between the business practices and claims that were actually filed and were actually false. Here, the plaintiffs, the relators, had absolutely no knowledge whatsoever of the contracts that Caremark had upon which they base the allegation that the claims were false. They had absolutely no knowledge of the submission of claims to a federal-funded agency. In fact, if you look at the first amended complaint, it was so poor in terms of its knowledge base that they didn't even, they were unable to name the five federal plans that these claims were actually submitted to. They named one, misnamed another, and drew a blank on the remaining ones. In their employment, they were pharmacists, they were clerks, they had no knowledge of the contracts, no knowledge of the actual claims, and obviously no knowledge of who it was the claims were actually submitted to. Instead, the essence of this case is the premise that was rejected in Cruz, and that is, given these business practices, there simply must have been some false claim filed somewhere with some federal agency. Once you find that the complaint was essentially based upon and derived from disclosed documents, you get to what's really the key issue in this case. There's no dispute as to what documents Mr. Leonard and the relators relied upon in preparing their third amended complaint. It's a set of documents which was first disclosed by Caremark voluntarily to the U.S. Attorney's Office and later disclosed to the relators during the course of discovery. And the issue is, are documents that are publicly disclosed that are turned over during discovery, then still publicly disclosed documents, or do they somehow lose that character and are transmuted into privately obtained information? To frame the issue is to obviously suggest the answer. Once information is publicly disclosed, it is an immutable characteristic. No act can transform it, put the proverbial toothpaste back in the bottle. Mr. Leonard correctly asserts that in Matthews, the court held that discovery itself is not a disclosure. It is not a public disclosure. And we don't contend that it is. Again, we're not asking you to overrule Matthews. Disclosure is a non-event. Whatever it was before it was discovered, discovery is a non-event. Whatever the information's character trait was prior to the time that it was turned over in discovery remains its trait afterward. To borrow or paraphrase a line from Justice Scalia in the Rockwell case, it would be claims laundering is what I would call it. You take publicly disclosed information, obtain it in discovery, you launder it of its public disclosed nature, and suddenly you've got a case. The best way to refute Mr. Leonard's theory is to apply it. The classic instance of a parasite, a parasitic litigation, is someone who relies on an indictment. But according to Mr. Leonard's theory, if you applied it, a relator could file a case based on a legally inadequate claim, as was the case here. And again, Judge Conlin found the first complaint to be legally inadequate, and that issue was not raised here on appeal. So there's no question that they did that. And according to Mr. Leonard, you file an inadequate complaint, between Rule 26 disclosures and early discovery, you get the indictment. Maybe you're even lucky to get the judgment and conviction order through discovery. According to Mr. Leonard, that's no longer publicly disclosed information. So then you file your amended complaint based on the indictment. If you're lucky and you attach the judgment and conviction order that you obtained through discovery, file a motion for summary judgment and the case is over. In that case, the relator has brought absolutely nothing to the table. It can't possibly be right, because that application of his theory, Mr. Leonard's theory, would open the floodgates to classically parasitic litigation. Anything that's publicly disclosed could be cleansed of its publicly disclosed nature simply by getting it again through discovery. The False Claims Act richly rewards relators who are able to file a complaint that does not depend upon, and it's not derived from, information that's been disclosed to the government. A relator who simply regurgitates publicly disclosed information, as was the case here, or recycles it, adds nothing of value to the case or the government. And in essence, the government would be paying them for something it's already gotten for free. As the court said in Feingold, quote, where a public disclosure has occurred, that authority is already in a position to vindicate society's interests, and a quitom action would serve no purpose. There'd be no benefit to society by allowing someone to recycle information already in the government's files simply because they obtained it through discovery. It would also be inconsistent with Rockwell. Justice Scalia talked there in finding that you need to focus on the amended complaint, not the original complaint. He said, such a limitation, that is to the original complaint, would leave a relator free to file a trivial complaint, end quote, and later amend the complaint to include theories copied from the public domain or from materials in the government's possession. That's exactly what happened here. They filed an inadequate complaint and were able to amend it from materials that indisputably were in the government's possession. They're simply not the original source. Mr. Leonard, in his brief, talks about that, well, they did assist the government, but an assistance is not enough under the statute. That's clear from the Matthews case. It's not a reward for information in the sense of a tip line. If you call a federal hotline and say, I know of some business practices that are awful, that's not enough under this statute. In fact, even if you're the but-for cause of the information getting in the hands of the government, that's Matthews. The relator's subpoena in that case, based on what she had learned in private discovery, was what provoked the ultimate disclosure to the FMHA that her guarantee had existed and it had never been disclosed to the government. I'd like to address Mr. Leonard's arguments with respect to the 9B, 12B6 issues. Again, his argument that as long as I lay out something and I give one example, and we can extrapolate that across various plans, violates the discussion in Rockwell, which says that there is no such thing as jurisdiction in gross. Just because you have one false claim, you've got to independently establish jurisdiction with respect to every false claim. And this complaint is based upon this notion that you can extrapolate one instance across conduct involving five separate, distinct, independent plans with separate, distinct, independent contracts and separate, distinct, independent claims. The best example of that it has to be their allegations with respect to the turnaround time. They take a handful of examples and say that based on this, we want you to extrapolate this across 13 million claims. You know, they don't even specify, and Your Honor asked about Rule 8A. You would have to, in order to understand what the turnaround times were, you would have to plow not through just the complaint. You've got to plow through 1,000 pages or more of exhibits that include the contracts. What reason was there to not specifically alert the court as to what the turnaround provisions were with respect to each one? And I suggest the answer to that is that the news wasn't good. The one plan, for instance, that Mr. Leonard identifies as with an example in the turnaround time allegations actually says 90% of the claims have to meet these turnaround times. So in order to even begin to get inside the ballpark, he's got to articulate a basis for concluding that if you use his analysis of the 13 million claims, that 1.3 million of those claims violated the turnaround time provisions. And then you got to look at whether or not on an overall basis that meant that the representation to the plans that they had met the turnaround time provisions were false. He also, in his oral argument, talks about CRUS. CRUS stands for the proposition that unless there's an obligation, a contractual obligation to credit, then a universal obligation, as they allege in their complaint, then there can be no false claim. The issue of who pays for returns is obviously not addressed, we agree, specifically in the contract. But you can't take a contract, particularly a third party who is analyzing a contract between two sophisticated parties, and claim now on appeal, well, okay, it's not there. There's an extrinsic ambiguity, which is not alleged in the complaint. We still don't know exactly what it means, but maybe the judge can figure it out. You can't, as the court held in Lammers, you can't base an allegation that requires scienter, as the False Claims Act does, on a contract interpretation, and certainly an unspecified implied obligation in a contract that they claim now is ambiguous, but never point to the ambiguity. With respect to the CCM allegations, another example of there's no reason why, in terms of this authorization, they claim they've interviewed the doctors, but it's just, as Judge Conlon pointed out, pure boilerplate. When you read that, it doesn't tell you why they concluded that the thing was unauthorized. Doesn't say they spoke to the prescriber, doesn't say the prescriber or even their office staff ever said they didn't authorize it. You're just left in the dark, and again, because they've done these interviews, there's no reason, no excuse. The CCR allegations with respect to the letter, again, just read the agreement, and you'll see that the definition presumes causation. And to the extent that Mr. Leonard has an argument, again, it's ambiguous, and it's not something that you can prove scienter based on. I see my time's gone, and I just want to say two things. One is that we ask the court to either find that there is no jurisdiction here and modify the judgment accordingly, or to affirm the district court's holding that the complaint, that leave to amend ought not to be granted because the complaint violates 9B, and we respectfully suggest 8A as well. And if the court has any questions, I'd be happy to answer it.
Thank you, Mr. Pearl.
Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time does Mr. Leonard have?
I would like to briefly address the issue about the obligation to credit within the contracts. We concede there is no specific provision in the contracts that says this is what you do in a return drug situation. However, I would like to point out to the court that there is a provision that bears directly upon this issue. Each and every contract requires that Caremark only bill for a prescription. Prescription is specifically defined in every contract as the lawful order of a physician only. In this case, we have alleged examples and, in fact, numerous hundreds of instances where Caremark provided something that was other than the prescription, meaning they sent out the wrong dose, they sent out the wrong medication, they changed the drug. Under the contract, when they send something that's not the lawful order of the doctor, then it's not a prescription, and you can't bill for it. Whether you find that out before you send the invoice or whether you send out the invoice after, it doesn't matter. With respect to Mr. Pearl's interpretation of Matthews, I couldn't disagree more strongly. Matthews, at page 11 in my copy, but says, basically, under this reading, meaning you put the documents in the government's files and your case is over jurisdictionally, once the bank had informed the FMHA of the facts surrounding misrepresentation, Matthews' claim was based upon that disclosure, even if she knew about those facts, entirely apart from the bank's admission through examination of documents produced in discovery. And the court goes on to reject that and says it doesn't matter. There can be a public disclosure. If you have an independent source of knowledge, you still win. Finally, with regard to Lamers, this court would also have to overturn Lamers. In Lamers, this court held the relator did not have to have knowledge of the submission of false claims. He needed to have sufficient knowledge of the schemes. And finally, with respect to the Rockwell case, Mr. Pearl says it stands for the proposition that if you plead one false claim, you have to plead them all. That's not what it says. Rockwell stands for the proposition that if you have one claim properly before the court, for instance, a return drugs claim, it doesn't give the court jurisdiction over a CCM or CCR, and that's not what we're contending here. We're contending that if you examine each of the causes of action independently, jurisdiction is appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leonard. Our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.